Hi, my name's Chris Parker. I live in Oak Park. That's a suburb.
They probably figured that out.
This is Brad, Sarah, and Daryl. And we're in trouble.
Ain't no doubt.
See, me and my boyfriend Mike, tonight's our anniversary. But then he went and canceled, and now I'm stuck watching these three.
Come on, feet! Start moving!
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus review of Adventures in Babysitting.
I'm gonna call my mom.
No mothers. They'll kill us. No way.
A Podbean backer exclusive review, chosen by David Smith.
He's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Hosted by Jacob.
You big city scum sucker.
Stuart.
You kids must be from the suburbs.
And Arnie.
Are you a gearhead and a sex fiend?
This podcast is spoiler-filled and contains harsh language.
Don't fuck with the babysitter.
Listener discretion is advised.
Good luck, babysitter.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Okay, Chris, just relax. Tonight is going to be the greatest night of your life.
Today we're discussing Adventures in Babysitting, starring Elizabeth Shue, Keith Coogan, Anthony Rapp, directed by Chris Columbus. This is the Now Playing co-host who always has adventures in podcasting, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is Jacob, and I don't have a wiener. And it's dinner time. I'm really hungry. I want my wiener.
Okay. Adventures in Babysitting. I'll bite. Why are we discussing this? I know it is the 35th anniversary. This movie did come out July 4th weekend, 1987. That is, folks, 35 years ago. All those babies have had grandbabies by this point.
And Elizabeth Shue's still effing hot.
Why are we watching this, Stuart? I don't think I ever stopped since 1987. Constant rotation when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, I watched this so often as a kid. I missed it in theaters. I didn't even know it came out in theaters.
Yeah, it was just a rental my parents came home with one night, and then redubbed it, and I watched it all the time.
I rented this and Can't Buy Me Love the same day. Both Touchstone Pictures, both kind of similarly not kiddy in certain ways and very kiddy in other ways.
They say titty in Can't Buy Me Love.
They don't show it, although they tease it. But I went to the wrong Bradley Whitford movie is what it was. Bradley Whitford was having quite a month in July 1987. July 3rd, 1987, Adventures in Babysitting. I was busy that weekend moving to Florida. But July 10th, 1987, I was there for him in Revenge of the Nerds 2. So July was really...
Bradley Whitford month, that July. Celebrate him all month long.
But the real reason we're here is because David Smith has pledged for us to review this. David is with us now. David, why don't you tell us, why are we talking Adventures in Babysitting?
So I grew up watching this movie. I was -2 when it came out.
Now I feel old.
We had it on tape and I watched it a million times. It's kind of a comfort movie for me. I still watch it every couple of years or so. And every time I show it to like a new person who's never seen it, they always seem to have a good time with it. I think it's just kind of a pretty good movie and sort of indicative of the kind of mid-budget, semi-subversive family movie that we don't really get anymore. Plus, I thought it would be interesting to see you guys talk about something that's kind of outside of your wheelhouse. It's not like a genre movie or part of a big franchise.
It's part of the MCU. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that, we are in part covering it right now because it does include Thor, and he's got a new movie out. True.
And D'Onofrio is back in the MCU again as of last winter. So, yeah, all kinds of Marvel ties. But yeah, this is a straight-up comedy. We don't really review those that often. We have reviewed some, but it's also the directing debut of Chris Columbus. We've just recently reviewed him with a couple of Harry Potter films.
Yeah, he had made a name for himself as a screenwriter. He had made the Triple Crown would be exaggerating. One was a flop, but he had had Gremlins, he had had Goonies, and it had Young Sherlock Holmes, which was my favorite of the three, damn it. And because he wrote three big scripts, they said, go ahead and direct a movie. Surprisingly, he didn't write this movie. It feels like he wrote this movie. It feels like this is the first draft of Home Alone.
I was going to say, I thought John Hughes was behind this, but no.
It really apes Hughes so badly.
Chicago suburb, Chicago, all that, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that this David Simkins, who did write this movie, watched Ferris Bueller a few times.
Ferris Bueller, Weird Science, 16 Candles. Yeah, quite a few John Hughes references going on here. And that Columbus and Hughes would go on to work together seems almost preordained. So, Stuart, David, Jacob, and I grew up watching, rewatching, and re-rewatching this movie. How many times have you seen it?
I have seen it. Here's the thing. I was really getting into movies, and I mean really getting into movies, when this came out in theaters. I didn't go to theaters to see it, but I was cutting out newspaper posters of every movie made, and I had giant scrapbooks, and I definitely remember her hanging off the rope. They sold it like it was Indiana Jones. Elizabeth Shue is going to be swinging around skyscrapers like Spider-Man while trying to babysit kids.
I love that airbrushed art. Perfect for like a VHS cover, the way it's vertical. Like, great piece to sell you on it.
Mm-hmm. So I eventually rented it. I never went to the movie theaters in 87, 88. I always waited for VHS. And I know I saw it because I saw everything that hit the new release counter on VHS at my video store. But it didn't leave much of an impression. I can't say that I remembered anything about it other than it was set in Chicago. It had the climax of them swinging around the Diamond Head building. And Thor. That would have been what I could have told you.
That's crazy, because you're saying this is 35 years old. I probably haven't seen it in 34 years. And I was sitting there calling out the lines before they came out. Like, my girls were blown away that I had this movie memorized because I just watched it so much as a kid. But I have not seen it, like, for a very long time.
I imagine the last time I had this in heavy rotation with Can't Buy Me Love was probably 1990. So I hadn't seen it in a long time. But having no idea David was going to ask us to do it, my wife and I just watched it out of the blue last year. It was on sale on iTunes. It was like $3 to own. We're like, we're watching Adventures in Babysitting tonight. And much like you, Jacob, we were calling out the punchlines before they hit. We both remembered this movie so well. And so I had this movie pretty fresh in my mind. Between 1990 and last year, I honestly didn't have to watch the movie for this review. I could have just sat down and gone right into a review and a plot summary, but no, I did rewatch it one more time.
Can you give me the greatest hits, like real bullet points about what it was about this movie? Because the 80s had a lot of this kind of movie. Why did this one stick out?
Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah, I can't deny that I had a massive crush on Elizabeth Shue.
I mean, that opening number, like, I'm in.
This is the movie that made her, right? She was just kind of the girlfriend in Karate Kid and Back to the Future. This was her first starring role.
It's Cocktail that made her the next year.
Oh, God. You can stand on that if you want to, but I disagree, Arnie.
But as for what it is about this one, I really got into the soundtrack of it when I was a kid. I mean, we got some Rolling Stones going on here. You got some blues.
Great blues soundtrack, yeah.
And the fact that it was set in Illinois, Chicago, an area, you know, that I went to a lot. I was able to recognize the geography when they really were shooting in Illinois and not Vancouver. But it just was hearkening to me because I was, yay, Illinois, I'm from there. And then the chaos of it, it really went along with, as we said way back in our review of Friday the 13th Part 8, my idea of what happens to you if you're caught alone as a kid in the big city. The lords of hell are going to come at you with switchblades. Criminals are going to chase you around town. A guy with a hook for a hand is going to take your car. I mean, this was both a cautionary tale and madcap and something I just really had as, yeah, comfort food for movie watching when I just wanted something to watch after school.
And I think there was something subversive about this one. We're going to get the F word with that gang fight on the subway. The fact that the MacGuffin in this is a playboy, like, that blew my mind as a kid. Like, you could do that in a movie?
This is a Disney film, you know?
Yes, I know.
Well, be truthful, it was a touchstone film when Disney was trying to sell the idea they could make PG and PG-13 entertainment. That's what sticks out to me now watching this movie, is it's striking a difficult balance of trying to be sophisticated enough to get teenagers and young adults while still playing to a family audience at a time when Disney movies didn't exist.
And just to your point, Jacob, this is a record holder. It is the only PG-13 movie to get two F-bombs in it.
Really? The only film PG-13 with two? That's crazy.
Well, depending on what version you watch. On Disney Channel, it's Don't Mess with the Babysitter.
Please tell me you didn't watch that version.
I did watch that version, but I also watched the other version because you told me I couldn't just watch the Disney version. So
how much of the Playboy is in that Disney version?
You would be surprised. Everything visually is the same. Not a frame is cut. It is all dialogue that has been removed. That's troubling.
They didn't blur the Playboy at all in any section?
None. And by the way, why would they? She's clothed and has writing all over her. She's not nude.
True. That is actually Elizabeth Shue. She did actually go to the Playboy Mansion for the shoot. And yes, she did not take her clothes off until Cocktail.
Okay, so a PG-13 kids movie, still relatively new at that time. PG-13, the rating had only been around for about 3 years. And this movie did open poorly. I want to point out it came in 7th, behind Dragnet, Spaceballs, Innerspace, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Witches of Eastwick, Predator, Untouchables, Roxanne. Like, this thing got buried.
There's a lot of good movies in that list. Yeah.
No wonder I missed it. I saw, like, all but two of those movies in theaters.
It did end up making $35 million, which is a pretty good haul, but this one struggled. And I do think most people discovered it at home.
I have to say, another thing that appealed to me around this time, because of the church I was raised in, like, babysitting was a big thing because people had a bunch of kids. Like, I was the oldest of 6. I knew how to change diapers by the time I was, like, 8 years old. And so, like, I was one of our congregation's babysitters. So I think that was part of the fun for it, too, is, like, this was a job I was also doing on the weekends to make some money.
So, Jacob, did people fuck with the babysitter?
No one fucked with me.
Yeah. But you're right. I was babysitting kids by the time I would have rented this. And I think there was a popular book series, The Babysitter's Club. Like, yeah, it had a built-in youth appeal, which is why parents might blanch if they stay and watch with their young ones. The babysitter is going to be fine playing it for the kids. But if the parents come home and see some of this stuff, yeah, there might be a problem.
When her boyfriend Mike cancels a special dinner date, 17-year-old Chris Parker, played by Elizabeth Shue, decides to take a babysitting gig. Chris is supposed to have a quiet evening in the Chicago suburbs watching TV with 8-year-old Sarah, but Sarah's older brother Brad has a major crush on Chris, so he decides to hang around. Hanging out with Brad is his best friend Daryl, who has a Playboy magazine in which the centerfold is a near twin for Chris. Lest Chris see the nudie mag, Brad throws it out. The evening takes a turn when Chris's friend Brenda calls. She's run away from home and is in downtown Chicago, stranded and penniless. She begs Chris to come rescue her, so Chris and her 3 charges get in the car for a quick trip to the city. A blown tire begins a series of misadventures that end up with the kids on the run from criminals. These chop shop mafioso are chasing the kids because Daryl stole their Playboy to replace his dad's copy that Brad had thrown out. Unfortunately, the criminal's Playboy was full of notes that it could incriminate the men. And guys, I don't understand it. I mean, these guys keep their notes in Playboy. When I take a Playboy into a movie with a Sharpie to take my notes for now playing, people look at me funny.
Maybe that's why you have such a hard time reading what you wrote.
Plus, the pages stick together. Oh, it's just no. All a mess.
We're going into real Paul Rubens territory here.
But appropriate for this movie, actually. I was like, oh, the children. No, they will get this and worse.
You would not be shocked if there is a scene in an adult theater in this film.
No. Yeah, it should have happened. Should have happened.
Eventually, the group gets the repaired car and starts to head for home. When Chris sees her boyfriend's car outside the fancy restaurant where she was supposed to dine that evening. While she goes to confront her cheating boyfriend, Mike, little Sarah goes off on her own to a toy store. The criminals start to chase her, so she goes to find her parents at the Associates Center office building. Still on the run, Sarah has to climb out a top window on that building's slanted roof, and one of the goons climbs out after her. Chris, Daryl, and Brad arrive and save Sarah. They pick up Brenda and race back to get home before Sarah's parents. They narrowly make it back, safe, and the parents are none the wiser, as credits roll. So the biggest stretch for this movie, and it's so easy for me when I saw this and I was 14 years old, and it's so hard for me to accept now, is this entire movie's premise is, it's better to die than to get in trouble with your parents.
I mean, that's the theme of every 80s kids film, I think. Let's go search for treasure.
Stuart, you know I subscribe to this. There was one time when you and I said goodbye and you're like, should I call your parents? And I said, no, if I die tonight, it's better than getting in trouble.
I mean, haven't we all had those moments?
So you must give this movie. If you take into account that all of this could have been handled with a single phone call to the place where there's a party, pre-cell phone, so you couldn't call them directly, but a single phone call to a lot of different people could have fixed this whole movie.
Yeah, but this is from the kid's perspective, and as a child, I didn't want to get in trouble. I'd rather die than get in trouble, so very relatable at the time.
You went a totally different direction. I thought the hardest thing to grab onto here was that Elizabeth Shue was a 17-year-old in high school.
She was 23 when this was made, which isn't outside the range.
Not for the 80s, that's not crazy.
I think the Beverly Hills 90210 cast was all in their early 20s when they were playing 15 and 16. Yeah. But it is hard to picture the Elizabeth Shue that we see dancing around the first scene as a babysitter.
And I did see that they wanted Molly Ringwald, which would have made sense. At this time, 1987, she had just been coming off Pretty in Pink and Breakfast Club. She would have been a much bigger star than, again, the girlfriend in Karate Kid.
Yeah, they went through a lot of different people. It came down to Elizabeth Shue or Valerie Bertinelli, believe it or not. It was like...
weird.
Those were the two finalists. I think they made the right choice here.
Hmm. But yeah, she is in this weird... you know, my brother dated someone that was outside of high school when he was in high school, but that's what we're to get here, right? She's trying to be an adult. She wants to go to French restaurants. Her friends are over it. They're seniors. One's going to run away this night. So she's feeling the pull of adulthood. And to me, the arc is that she realizes she should still be a kid, maybe? Don't grow up too fast. Don't do centerfolds? I'm not sure. You tell me.
Yeah, I was really looking. What is her arc? And early on when she goes over to the Andersons, Sarah's asking her if she's going to go to college. I'm like, oh, maybe. And then we'll meet a teen prostitute. She definitely doesn't want to go that way. Like, I thought we were going to get this big arc where she realizes, yeah, I need to go to college and become a woman. But I don't know what she learns.
All right, here's what I will take. I also was paying attention to arcs. I believe she started this movie thinking she was an adult woman, mm-hmm. ready for the world, ready right. for marriage. I mean, when right. she's doing this opening dance number, which is the least adult thing anyone can do. I don't know if anyone on this podcast dances around to maybe My Boyfriend's Back or some other 50 staple while getting ready for a date. But she thinks she's ready for marriage. She thinks she's ready for restaurants. And throughout the night, she is going to learn what it truly means to be an adult and take responsibility for children and for one's own choices through boyfriends and what have you. I saw this as her night of maturation.
I'm hurt, Ernie. You clearly aren't a subscriber to my TikTok because I kill this dance.
You got a TikTok? I want it.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we definitely see that she's crushed when Mike shows up, not even nicely dressed after she carefully put together her very 80s attire and says, yeah, I have to cancel. We can all tell it's a lie when he's like, I'm not going to kiss you because I'm infectious. I have to babysit a sick younger sister. We know he's a scumball. He won't even accept her offer to come over and make chicken noodle soup. But it will be her arc to realize she's not ready for this adult life.
But she's going to end up with a college student at the end. I don't know how you say that's her arc.
Why doesn't he kiss her? I mean, he's not dumping her. He's cheating on her. He claims he might be infectious, but I guess it's just trying to sell to us, the audience, there's something else at play here. Because
yes.
If he's cheating on her, I figure he'd still want to keep up that illusion. He doesn't plan on dumping her, I don't think.
Or was it all over? It's confusing and underdeveloped and doesn't really matter. You're right. I think because they recognize that a bulk of the audience will be 13, 14, and maybe not savvy to the lies of adultery and cheating, we have to make it particularly obvious that he's definitely not going to be babysitting tonight, and that she is a fool for believing him.
Yeah, he'll drop a line later that she's like locked at the knee. She's not opening those legs up, he's not interested, so maybe he'll keep her around for a try or two, but he's more or less done with her.
Mm-hmm. So that leaves her night open to babysitting.
Well, first, it leaves her open to hanging out with Brenda.
Yeah.
The most clumsily inserted character here that somehow between the date that doesn't happen and the babysitting that does happen, Brenda comes over to introduce herself and complain about her stepmother.
I mean, not complain about her stepmother, plot to poison her tab soda with Drano. Like, and then like really does run away. Like, for living in Oak Park and seemingly a lot of privilege, she's very damaged. I would actually prefer the movie about Brenda to the movie about Chris.
She does have adventures in a bus station that are just about equal to the adventures Chris and company have.
I mean, her adventures are probably a lot more real.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, I don't know what led her to such an extreme. And certainly, yeah, what we get will, of course, be some amusing slapstick interludes. But yeah, I want to know the story on Brenda. Penelope Ann Miller, she did end up becoming one of those three named girls of the 90s, like Jennifer Jason Leigh and Mary Louise Parker. She worked. I recognized her, but I couldn't tell you from what.
But I hadn't paid very close attention to this movie, maybe ever, as far as paying attention to every line, writing down every detail. I was trying to figure out, why was Chris called by the Andersons to babysit Brad? Brad is 15. I remember being 15, and my parents would hire me babysitters when they'd leave the country, leading to Arnie having all sorts of babysitter fantasies, none of which ever came true. But as far as just going out for an evening by the time I was 15, I was being left home alone. So it's only on this viewing that I catch Brad was supposed to be leaving the house. Chris was only babysitting Sarah.
Yeah, he's supposed to go over to his friend Daryl's house, but he's got a crush on Chris, so I guess he's staying around now.
Yeah, and Keith Coogan, I don't know, did he have a career? Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, Toy Soldiers. I didn't really recognize him.
He shows up, he looks very different, he lost his hair, but he works a lot.
Okay.
I've seen him in stuff.
I didn't recognize him, but Daryl is Anthony Rapp, who was Broadway, Rent. He would end up making the Rent movie with Chris Columbus.
I have not seen that, but hatred just came flooding back to me. Like, I never liked Daryl as a kid. He is the most annoying character in this. And wow, just like the physical reaction I had to him and like his line delivery. You think? Like, I hated it all when I was a kid. Hate it all now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is perhaps telling. He was the one I most wanted to be of the crew.
No! He is the worst!
He was always there with the funny line and the dirty mag. I felt a kinship.
Yeah, not the sensitive one who has crushes on Chris and can't quite articulate them. Again, all of these kids are going to have their fantasies realized tonight. And Daryl's fantasy is to make out with a hot chick. Yeah, he's definitely the hornier one. Brad is the one we're supposed to like because he's sensitive.
He does call Thor a bad word, though.
Yeah, no, he's not so sensitive that he's using homo or weirdo, again, a Disney Channel version.
Sarah does get a good one in on Brad here, though, because Brad does use the H word. She says she'll tell Chris about all the love poems Brad writes, and Chris is standing right behind Brad, so hearing this whole thing.
Yeah, these kids are all annoying to me, and my thought was that they would be creating the problems. They would be the reason why they wind up downtown in Chicago. I couldn't think of what happened. I would have never guessed in a million years that Brenda was the setup for the night. I thought that they would have done something terrible and Chris would go downtown to try and fix it.
I mean, they aren't going to help the situation, but I agree. Like, these kids, Brad, he's kind of milquetoast, like, stand in the corner, not a thing. But yeah, Daryl and Sarah, the sister, who, like, I was fascinated because I'm like, whoa, she likes comic book stuff as a kid. Like, even though no one knew who Thor was, that seems like a pretty obscure choice. But, like, that fascinated me. But yeah, she's annoying. I don't like her either.
This predates my reading of any Marvel comics save for one single issue of Ghost Rider. And so I, too, thought Thor was lame to like as a fan. And I was Team Brad when it came to that. I couldn't believe anybody was really into Norse mythology. I thought it was Norse mythology. I didn't think that it was actually going to be a Marvel Comics character for many years.
And I just want to say, we're on the topic of all these kids. Costume design, like, can this be more 80s? Again, Sarah with her Thor helmet and, like, a rainbow-colored outfit. Chris with that pink shirt. Like, a lot of 80s colors going on in this film.
Which is, of course, why it makes it fun. Like, if this were the 90s, like, I never saw Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. Probably has a very similar vibe.
Not a classic like this.
Yeah, but I imagine because it's the 90s, to me, that doesn't hold the same magic. I don't know how else to put it. The 80s has a tackiness and a grandiosity that no other decade would attempt. It was all the cocaine. I'm convinced of that much. But yeah, it's an ugly, ugly decade. And that's why it's kind of fun to go back there and see these ugly children behaving ugly. I mean, when it comes clear that Chris is going to have to take him downtown, what does Daryl say? He's hoping he gets raped. I'm like, oh, look, that was actually the moment where I went and looked at the rating. I was like, PG-13. And of course, cut from the Disney Channel version.
Oh, see, I told you not to watch that version.
I wanted to compare. I saw the version you wanted me to. And then I said, how is this going to play on Disney Channel? What would they censor?
Apparently all the good things, but here is just another contrivance because I didn't pay attention in the past. Chris does say, Brad, can you just watch Sarah? I'm going downtown for like half an hour. It's not going to be that long. You are of age. You could watch your sister. It's kind of not even really a good reason why Brad doesn't. I think he just goes, no.
Yeah, they basically just blackmail her. We're going to tell mom that you left us if you do this. To, like, I'm thinking through this scenario. I'm like, offer your night's pay to them to keep them quiet. Like, whatever you do not let them get in that car.
The one thing I will say is the boys are just obviously wanting to be around Chris. Wherever she's going, they want to go. But for Sarah, truly later, when you see them in some of the worst scenarios they're going to be in, she's grinning ear to ear. There's something very much about her that loves danger. I don't know whether it's those corrupting Thor comics,
yes,
that have warped her mind, but she definitely enjoys how bad things get. So the idea of going into the city, we'll learn too that she believes, and this is kind of a stretch, she believes that Thor is actually alive and working in Chicago. I don't know that he had a Chicago connection. Again, she's going to have her fantasy realized. She can maybe see the home of Thor and maybe even meet him, and she will.
And I also think from Sarah's point of view, it's just fun to get out when you're a kid. Like, how often do you get to go into a big city or get to go anywhere besides maybe the grocery store with your mom?
Yeah. I hadn't been to Chicago when I saw this movie. I wouldn't have gone there for another year or so. So again, for just as a viewer, that's what's fun about it. Being a kid alone in a big city like this was merely a fantasy at this point. I hadn't done it.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't gone to Chicago alone. My parents had taken me there many times a year, mainly for their own reasons, and I just was kind of stuck along for the ride.
Operas, as I recall.
Yes, operas and medical conventions.
They sure know how to entertain a child.
That's how Batman was made, Arnie. You could have been Batman.
But this is where the MacGuffin of the movie gets lost. The Playboy magazine. Brad throws it out of the back of a car. I can relate. I mean, you're not supposed to have porno mags when you're that young. And versus getting caught, I have thrown many away as a youngster.
Yeah, but do you toss them out of the car while, like, someone's looking over their shoulder? What do you got back there? Like, just stick it back in your jacket. Like, it feels kind of extreme. They toss it out.
Yeah, a lot of things are contrivance. Let's just put
yes.
it, you know.
As an adult, I see that.
Yes. Watching this movie, it is not airtight with logic and reasons. It's not about that. It's very much a child's point of view. I'm wondering, how old was Chris Columbus when he put this out? I mean, again, this is 4 years after Gremlins. You know, someone that's probably in their late 20s, he's very much in touch with the thinking of our demographic.
He would have been, yeah, late 20s, and I think that's young enough, hip enough, where he'd be able to relate.
Right. And it was very popular. Again, so many movies, I want to stress this. There weren't Disney movies. There weren't animated films. There weren't kiddie entertainment. The 80s was the one where they mashed it all up. Spielberg said you could appeal to all ages, and you could have these kid empowerment fantasies that would have adult content. This one just happens to be a little bit more salacious with pornos and such.
That's what I'm going to ask. Is the Playboy going too far? And I know they're not going to show anything. She's going to have like some lingerie on or some fur. It's going to cover everything. We see no body parts, but the mere fact that it's a Playboy feels, again, in our day, if it was done now, groomers, like, what are you doing to our children? It would be very scandalous.
That's where I was going to go is today, I think everybody would be clutching their fucking pearls over a Playboy, but I'm sorry, when I was 12, guess what I was looking at when I went over to my friend's house? We kept stealing his dad's Playboys. And it was a hunt. It wasn't just a hobby. It was a quest. A quest for the nipple. And it was my most permanent thoughts. And just constantly looking for porn as an underage preteen.
Yeah, for our younger listeners, we didn't have no Pornhub. Like, porn was hard to get as a kid.
Right, no internet, no access to all of these ideas. So yes, your dad's mag that he had hidden away was it.
I literally was walking home from a video store one day, and a nudie magazine was in the middle of a road.
Oh yeah, you'd find him in the gutter.
just in the middle of the street was a wee magazine. So I guess, you know, somebody like Brad threw it out of the window of the car and Arnie was there to pick it up.
Dodging traffic like in Bowfinger to get to that magazine.
So I don't know people today can understand that in the 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, seeing naked ladies was a perfectly healthy hobby for underage boys to attempt.
And I do feel like this kind of content was in other, you know, I call Chris Columbus kind of like in my mind because he makes children's entertainment safe and all of that. But if you think about Goonies, there was that whole bit about the penis breaking off the David statue.
Yeah, Michelangelo's David.
It was always there. The Bad News Bears used the N-word. I mean, like 70s and 80s, quote unquote, kids entertainment just was more risible than the kids' entertainment is today.
We were latchkey kids, and they were making films for latchkey kids because they knew the parents weren't around.
That's true.
To be metaphorical, we drank from the garden hose, and these kids need filtered water.
Yes, so a lot's happening in this car. Besides the porno magazine being set up, we also have the idea that Daryl holds a grudge against Mike. If we already thought Mike was probably lying to Chris, now we find out that he beat up on Daryl because he touched his car and he has that annoying vanity license plate, which was very new at the time. So cool.
So cool.
Both the car and the license plate, if you believe IMDb trivia, were actually Bradley Whitford's. Bradley Whitford drove it to the set and Chris Columbus is like, that fits your character. We're using him in the movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I might as well say tool. It's really, again, we know by this point that Chris is wrong. And, you know, if you're savvy enough, you realize she'll probably even catch him in the act here as she's heading downtown. She's also telling a ghost story to pass the time. And she talks about a hook-handed face scraper that will now color their thoughts once they break down and a hook-handed tow truck driver comes to help them.
Yeah, handsome John Pruitt. You could trust that name.
With the big letter P and Christmas lights and his grill of his truck and a scraggly beard.
Yeah, I looked up this guy because I'm like, oh, he's had to have a career like in weird B-movies, horror stuff. He's just got that face. But no, like, has done very little. Like, this is his biggest thing.
He's no Large Marge. No. I feel like trucker entertainment was coming to an end by the late 80s, but we had had a lot of it in the 70s, Convoy and what have you. That was a very old generation thing to have truck drivers, this grizzly folk. And he's, of course, going to challenge some of these stereotypes by being friendly. And yeah, he didn't lose his hand in Nam. He lost it changing a tire. And that's what they need to do.
Yeah, he even offers to pay for this new tire for them because, as we find out, Chris does not have her purse.
Yeah, or driver's license, too, although that never comes into play. Not having money is a bigger deal.
But wouldn't you know it, on the way to the repair shop, Pruitt gets a message over the radio from what I've, for the very first time, recognized as Vincent D'Onofrio's voice, telling him, hey, your wife is with that bastard again.
Yeah. I think a lot of this will go over, I don't know, maybe kids today are savvier. I don't know that I would have caught some of this stuff or been bothered by it. But like the fact that they pull up to the house and he goes in with a gun and like the guy is literally covered in blood and smashing through the window.
Pulling his pants up.
As a kid, this would have just run right over me. Like, well, yeah, he's real mad. This is what happens. But now I feel like there is a reactionary, like, are we okay letting young people see this moment? It's kind of funny how that works.
You're becoming a real boomer.
This came out, what, the same year as Fatal Attraction? This is the very light version of that. Still the cautionary tale about infidelity.
Yeah. I mean, again, these are passed over as jokes. Maybe jokes for the parents or the babysitter that's taking the kids. And I think your kids are going to be, again, guns were in a lot of kids' entertainment. It was in E.T. I mean, you know.
Yeah, when he pulls out that gun, I remember as a kid, it's just like, that's what you do. And like, it's a movie. You have to have a gun to do what you need to do. Like, it felt very normal as a child.
So on the Disney Channel version, did they replace his gun with a walkie-talkie?
No, again, that's what I would applaud Disney Channel for. You could say they censored this movie.
They did.
They definitely cut out bad language, but at no point did they feel the need to... I don't know how you could, because everything is building a plot point. If you remove this scene, you would never understand why they're settling in a Cadillac with a car thief.
And this movie is going to play into a lot of stereotypes, and unfortunately, Joe Grip the car thief is one of them.
I mean, he's a car thief with a heart of gold. He wants to help these kids.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. But yes, it's a suburban nightmare for these kids from Oak Park, which I had guessed it was Oak Park before they even said it. I have friends that live there, and it is one of the wealthiest suburbs in Chicago. It's got Frank Lloyd Wright houses there, and you'll notice they have a Letterman jacket they're wearing, the Hemingway High. Ernest Hemingway was from there as well. It's very posh, very privileged. And yes, you can imagine people from Oak Park coming into the city and totally, even to this day, being scandalized by what they were seeing.
I was thinking a little bit of Risky Business. Another Chicago suburb, go into the city, have some problems, get chased by some gangsters kind of things going on here.
I suppose so, yeah. Again, my main reference for this is Ferris Bueller, because they have a similar idea of a short time span of having quote-unquote fun in downtown Chicago, aimed at the same demographic with the same rating. I forget that Chris Columbus didn't write Ferris Bueller, but you're right, it was John Hughes that wrote that one.
Yeah, the fact that this is like a series of skits, kind of like Ferris Bueller, we're going to go to this set piece and then that one, this more or less follows that same pattern.
It's a Rube Goldberg. And so, yes, the car thief is taking them to the chop shop where what? What would happen if they decided not to get up on the girders and escape?
I think they believe they're going to be murdered.
Right. But would they?
I don't know. Even when I was a kid, especially when I was a kid, this character called Bleak, like I looked up his career. He's did a lot of Westerns and like B movies in the 50s and 60s. But there is just something about the way his skin is stretched over his skull and the way he delivers his lines. Like he is scary. Yes, he's going to fully shoot him.
Yeah, I think you believe it because of the tropish way all of this is put together. Oh, Chicago. These are mobsters. Mobsters kill people. This is, again, suburban fears, like come alive. So I suppose by this movie's logic, yes, they would be murdered, but I would argue you'd never feel that. In this movie, because it is so broadly comedic, they even have this cutaway joke of we go to the party where the parents are and they're like, Sarah's probably hanging from the rafters now. Cut back to Sarah hanging from the actual rafters. Because they have that kind of comedy, I don't believe any child will be traumatized by all this violence. I really don't. I really think that you could play the tape and the kids will be okay.
But this entire movie does run shallow. Like, you ask, would the criminals kill them? I'd like to know more about that. I'd like to know why what looks to be an Italian mobster is in a Chicago chop shop at 10 o'clock at night or whatever time it is at this point, why he's keeping his notes in a Playboy, why he's writing down things that could incriminate him so badly.
I mean, I felt like, yeah, he's on a phone call taking the order from Philadelphia, and that was the closest thing for him to write in. My dad did that a lot. Whatever was sitting around the phone when he needed to take a message, he would just write it right on there.
Again, it all plays on hazy ideas about, like, we know those mobsters take numbers and, like, they write them down in books, and, yeah, they like lewd sexual things, so they would have Playboys lying around.
That's what I'm saying. It's a shallow movie. It's a lot of hand-wavy. We don't know exactly what they're doing, because I don't think the filmmakers understand or researched what chop shops do.
What more do you need to know about them, though?
Yeah, and I don't think comedies work that way. Well, I shouldn't say that. Some comedies are about knowing, but many comedies trade in broad stereotypes that show ignorance. You know, like, that's just, most comedies reduce people to their worst impulses, and they're not sophisticated.
But if Daryl hadn't stolen that Playboy, their evening would probably be over, right? I mean,
yeah, they wouldn't have chased him.
They'd still need $50, but they wouldn't be on the run. I was shocked watching it this time that their very first stop after getting on the run is a blues club. For some reason, this is such a big scene to me. I pictured it as near the climax.
I'm right there with you.
You would want it there because this is their opportunity to talk about everything they went through during the night. And the truth is, we're at the halfway mark of this movie. Like, there's still so much more that they've got to do. It does feel too early. I agree with you. They love this gag. And it's cringe-tastic.
Yes.
I mean, she's not lying. When Elizabeth Shue gets up there and says, I can't sing, boy, does she mean it. And God bless her for doing it anyway.
Hey, I will say this. I'm watching this film with my family. Girls have never seen it. My wife had never seen it. And she's just grumbling the whole time. But she loves the blues. And like, when they got to this, it was all about the guitar and the harmonica. Yeah, she's not paying attention to Elizabeth Shue. But this blues number won my wife over, much like these kids win the club over.
Yeah. To me, this is a kind of gross racist stereotype that they're afraid of the blues player because he's a dangerous black man and these are kids from the white suburbs. I mean, this guy, he's like, ain't nobody leaving without singing the blues. And she takes it like there's a knife to her throat. She looks so scared.
I mean, how would you feel if you went to a club and they're like, you got to sing to get out of it? Maybe you'd feel okay with that, Arnie. You've sang quite a bit on the show.
Yeah, let's just give a name to it. This is suburban panic. This is white flight. This is a bunch of white people that live in Oak Park that never see black people. And now they're in the urban, quote unquote, ghetto and having this dangerous night with these criminals. Yes, what I was saying earlier, when grotesque stereotypes reducing people to what you thoughtlessly might in passing discriminatorily think about them. Again, the homo comment, I mean, all of it, again, just speaks to the ignorance.
But it is a funny scene. I do agree. I get embarrassed for Elizabeth Shue. She has since come out and said that in her entire filmmaking career, this was the scene she had the most fun doing.
Mm.
Great. I'm glad you had fun. But it's one that I have to, like, turn my head away when you're doing the dance with the kids. And, man, you said that Elizabeth Shue can't sing, but that Sarah is way off key. Sarah makes Shue look good.
I don't know. I go with this whole scene because I grew up in the 80s and it was not uncommon to have a musical scene in the middle of your movie. I'm thinking of, like, Better Off Dead with a dancing cheeseburger.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say it was not uncommon to be on stage and you had to sing a song to get out.
Well, there was this in Ferris Bueller, right? Like, he got up on the float. It was the Beatles. But, like, yeah, there is that moment where they're thrust into public singing. That just feels like something that happens in this kind of comedy.
My favorite moment of this is that the criminals come in, see them on stage singing about the criminals, and at no point look perplexed.
Here's my question is, they tell the criminals that they got to sing the blues to get out of the club. And what is the logistics of this club? Does everyone have to sing? Do you have to just do it once in your lifetime and you got a free pass whenever you come back? Because it feels like very late nights trying to get everyone on stage to sing this song.
But this was like what I imagine nightclubs to be like that they were dangerous in this way that like you had to pass, you had to be amongst them. Like I didn't want to go into the Hard Rock Club because someone in fifth grade told me they make you shave your head into a mohawk. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm willing to risk that. And let's also point out the Blues Brothers was a big hit a few years before. So this was grifting on other popular comedy and punchlines. Like, this is just expected. And Michael Kamen, who did the music, had been doing this kind of blues rock stuff already with Lethal Weapon.
I gotta ask you, Stuart, though, they get out of this club. Is this next scene in the Disney cut where they meet a teenage prostitute?
Yep, that's actually the reason when I watched this original cut and I said I'm going to watch the Disney version is I would have laid money that they cut this. Because you could. This one, you didn't really need this moment. This moment is mostly about Brad trying to tell Chris she needs to go for a nice guy. Because obviously Mike is a jerk and he's a nice guy. And then all of a sudden, yeah, they just happen to run into, yeah, a girl like Chris. Or like Brenda, I want to point out that, like, that's what they're supposed to be doing, is finding Brenda. And this is an epiphany moment where they realize, oh, right, that's why we're here. But yeah, she's a 17-year-old prostitute. It's in the Disney cut, and not a line has been changed.
That's pretty shocking.
You said Elizabeth Shue doesn't look 17. This prostitute looks 34. I couldn't.
Hard life on the streets.
That Daryl is just, you know, he's as ready to go with the prostitute as he is with the Playboy.
I don't think he gets that it's a prostitute. He's like, I'm trying to get a date here.
But he does say, there is the line, you won't believe what this girl will do for $20.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah, I believe Daryl is the most savvy about this kind of stuff. And again, they all have their fantasies. Daryl's is that he's going to get lucky, whatever that means to, what is he, 14?
15 is, Brad's 15, so.
Yeah, we'll put him there. Yeah, he will get pretty lucky tonight. But again, maybe the best joke of Adventures in Babysitting is that the suburbanites never have any empathy for locals. Like, we are seeing crime and abuse. Here's a 17-year-old girl that needs help. Oh, let's go find Brenda and totally leave her here. Like, that just, it never occurs to them throughout this night that they, like, are seeing people that they could help.
You want these kids to learn lessons or have adventure? It's adventures in babysitting, not morals from babysitting.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Brenda's had some of the most slapstick stuff going on, making fun of homeless people and going full on Velma from Scooby-Doo when she loses her glasses.
Yeah, picking up that giant sewer rat.
Yeah, these jokes are, they're unavoidable. Like, you have to do it. You know everything that's set up when she's going for the kitten behind the Coke machine. We all know it's going to be some kind of rodent. And yeah, the hot dog vendor, that one was a little bit of a stretch, right? Slip me the cash and I'll slip you the wiener. Like, they didn't need to do that.
Man, that really took me back thinking about when people use checks to purchase things.
That's true. That's right. She was going to buy a hot dog with a personal check.
Not just a personal check, but like a third party check. Remember when you'd like sign the back of the check and then say,
could you sign checks over to people?
You can.
You can. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you could do it from a friend to a friend to a hot dog vendor, but the main kids jump on the L and now they're safe. They criminals cannot follow them now that they're on Chicago's elevated subway system.
Mm-hmm.
This is the scene where my parents had to pull out their two Betamax players to do a dub. We had to get the clean version. We got the Disney version before there was a Disney version because of, yes, the two F words. But I will, like, this is the line of the film.
It totally is the line of the film.
Again, it feels like straight out of Michael Jackson's Beat It or whatever. These two gangs are about to go at it. And, you know, they pull a switchblade. It should be pointed out, Brad, I think his fantasy is defending Chris. And so he gets to do that for the first time. He does it twice in this night. But for the first time, he gets to stare down the Lords of Hell and gets a switchblade in his loafer for his troubles. And yes, Elizabeth Shue, I don't know. Is this a big laugh line? Don't fuck with a babysitter?
Absolutely.
It is the line. When you say Adventures of Babysitting, this is what I think of.
Okay.
It would be like taking away Marlon Brando saying the horror in Apocalypse Now to cut Don't Fuck with the Babysitter. And that's why, you know, it's not just that Disney Plus censors its stuff, which is horrible and completely wrong to censor in any regard. But beyond that, it's that they're taking away the line of the movie. It's the line, this is the moment where we finally see Elizabeth Shue stand up. She has not taken a stand this entire movie. She has been on the run, dodging everything. It's finally when Brad gets stabbed in the foot that she is willing to take up arms and actually defend these kids. This is a major character moment. It's a funny line. It's an iconic line. And how dare they take it away from this movie? Fuck them!
I mean, it wasn't just Disney. TV edits was don't fool with the babysitter.
Yeah, yeah. You're right, it was fool. It wasn't mess. You're right, it was don't fool with the babysitter. Yeah.
She's also a witch and not a bitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To me, that doesn't make much of a difference. It's like an Arnold Schwarzenegger line, right? Like, it's just like a cheesy line that this is the braggadocio of people in 80s action movies.
I think there is something because, you know, we saw this as kids. And I don't know. In my family, that was a forbidden word. So, like, just to see that in children's entertainment, it was shocking. It felt dangerous. Like, that was a big allure as a kid to hear that word in this movie.
I forgot how powerful that word would be in the mouths of 13-year-olds in 1987.
Yeah, in 1987, to get a film with a Playboy and the F word, mind blown.
Yeah, I get that, but it requires me to go back in time. Like, watching this movie on the surface, even by today's standards, I believe, you know, we've pushed far beyond this on television. So it doesn't feel that shocking for her to say this.
Oh, yeah, my daughters watch way crazier stuff on the, like, not even necessarily R-rated, but, yes, just stuff on Netflix. Like, it's just, yeah, society has changed.
Again, what I would celebrate about this movie is how 80s it is and how edgy it is in its 80s-ness, making it cute in some weird way. Like, fuck doesn't have the power that it probably did back in 1987. It's more charming.
But do you even get one stitch for a wound? I think you have to have like two stitches to even make them stick. I think one stitch is called a Band-Aid.
Nope. I was hit by a car while riding a bike one time, tore off a lot of skin, put a big gash in my chin where they couldn't sew it because they're like, there's no skin to sew there. It's just got to heal. But my eyelid was torn off and they did one stitch, took one stitch to put it back on.
That's when you say it that way, though, I want them to give you three. Or 10. That's really gross to think about.
It wasn't the whole eyelid torn off. It's just like the little corner of it.
Okay, good. All right. That's fine then. All right. One's fine for that. But everyone gets something that they want. Brad really wants loving from Chris. The closest he's going to get is that Chris believes he's dead. She faints because the person in the bed next to them is dead, and she interprets it as Brad. Then when he comes out alive, she can hug him. And again, I want to point out that these people are oblivious to pain. There is a dead man in the bed, and they don't care.
I feel like we're not supposed to care either. Like, this doctor they picked.
Yeah, I don't recognize many of the people here. They just feel like types. They just feel like there were always these people in these kinds of movies throughout the 80s. Bronson Pinchot would have been the breakout star of this. He would have done this had he not been in Perfect Strangers at the time.
A little too convenient, though, isn't it, that Pruitt happens to be at the same emergency room as where they were after taking the L train and everything?
As an adult, yes, it's extremely convenient. Like, watching it this time, I'm like, oh, wow, he's just going to stroll in and give an exposition dump about where to get their car. As a child, like, that's what happens. Like, you go to the hospital, and that's where everyone goes when they get hurt. So, of course, you'd run into him there.
I don't know how far they are from where they broke down. I know, like, in Chicago geography, they are pretty much, you know, going around South Loop, like within a mile radius, most of the places they go to. But where they broke down on the freeway and all of that and how far the chop shop was, that's the only thing. But yeah, it could all be the same hospital, Cook County serving all of these people. It's within the realm of possibility. It doesn't bother me. It's good to have callbacks and characters that come back. And it's fun to see the adulterer still bloody, trying to get them, and Pruitt still knocking him around.
But yes, now they know where the car is, that they need $50 for the tire, because Pruitt ended up just replacing the windshield that he shot up earlier. And so that's going to lead us to a frat party, apparently.
Sarah has to pee, and apparently right next door to the hospital is a fraternity.
It did say University Hospital on the sign when they pointed it out, so...
And it's true. I mean, I can speak to that. UIC is right there in the mix. This is geographically For a movie set in Chicago, many times they betray like where things actually are. I remember around the same time, Jamie Lee Curtis was in a movie called Blue Steel, and she would like literally run into Griffith Park and then like end up at another location that is geographically like 10 miles away. They just did it because they wanted to cut cool locations together. I would say you could do an Adventures in Babysitting tour. If you so wanted, you could go to Chicago and see many of these things on a walk or a short L ride. And again, just geographically speaking, there is a hospital and a university campus right there next to downtown. Buddy Guy's Blues Club, all these things that are stand-ins in this movie, they do exist. You could go to them. And yes, the UIC party is where I think Daryl gets to have his fantasy. He's wanted to make it with a girl, and he winds up making out with Sarah Ann.
Yeah, forget about the bears and whatever else, the environment. What about making love and sex?
Mm-hmm. And drinking. Like, he gets a, I think it's a stein full of
popcorn.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, he's chugging beers, or at least trying to blend in with guys that are chugging beers.
And maybe I missed it. We're going to see Chris meet a new love. I call him not John Cusack, but apparently his name's Dan. But like as a kid, I'm like, oh, this looks like it's supposed to be John Cusack. It's not, though.
Yes, totally on that same page. I always thought this was fake John Cusack.
Yes, like they really wanted him for this role.
I don't know what George Newbern went on to do, but...
But maybe I missed the line. What year is he in college? Do we know?
I don't think it's clear.
Yeah, because when he says, to think of all the girls on this college campus, the cutest one would be from high school. Like, my daughters got really upset by that line. They did not like that.
Yeah, I think he would have been, you know, if he's pledged a fraternity and all of that and he's been there, he's at least a sophomore, right? So 2 years difference between them. But then again, who's Elizabeth Shue to judge? She obviously likes him older, Bradley Whitford. That's an appeal to her. Again, I think it is... If she has a character, it is that she wants to grow up. She wants to get married. She wants to be with older men. But this guy's going to be nice to her, whereas Mike never will.
And the actor is either the same age or a year younger than Elizabeth Shue. So I have to take him as probably like a sophomore. Not too creepy. I mean, there were a number of senior girls in my Catholic high school dating like guys close to 30 when we were graduating. So...
Okay, that's a little extreme. I do think in the 80s for a 17-year-old girl to be with someone in college, sophomore or under, like, that was normalized at least. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, I agree. That doesn't, as someone that isn't a parent, that doesn't bother me at all. But I can understand how it might upset parents now. That's how this stuff works. When you're a kid, you take it all in and go, shrug. Sure, this is the way the world works. And then when you're an adult, you go, the terrible messaging. What are they doing? Underage, all of this stuff.
Yes, it's called hypocrisy.
Yeah, but that's kind of fun, too. I think it's fun to have that thrown back at you, that you thought you could be cool with these movies. You have these distant memories that this movie is safe and Milk and Goonies, and then you remember, oh, it's full of all this stuff. It very much earns its PG-13.
Yeah, we should someday discuss Milk Money, where the bunch of 12-year-olds try to hire a hooker.
Oh, no. I gotta say, though, like, Dan... Hustle a bit more. You couldn't get the full $50. He gets 45, but he can't get the full 50 for that new tire.
Yeah, it's convenient because they have to have another complication. He drives them to the Dawson garage. We've had Dawson tease throughout this, the guy on the radio. And this is where Sarah is finally going to meet Thor. Or in this case, a blonde Vincent D'Onofrio, same summer as Full Metal Jacket. He had been Joker just 2 weeks earlier.
He looks so different in those two roles.
Yeah, how did he get in so much better shape for this one?
Well, you know, he's not that much in shape. That's another thing that's funny. It's like what we used to think of as built now, you know, by comparison.
I mean, he's no Chris Hemsworth, but he is lean in this.
Yeah, he's definitely lost the weight.
Yeah, he's lean, he's muscular, he's tall. I mean, that's a wig quite obviously being held on with a baseball cap. But I didn't know this was Vincent D'Onofrio for years and years. It was dating Marjorie that she told me that's Vincent D'Onofrio. I'm like, the guy from Men in Black? No way is that him.
That was your reference, Men in Black.
Mm. I mean, I'd seen Full Metal Jacket, but I'd seen Men in Black a lot more.
This is one of the few memories I had from watching this back in the 80s, the one time that I did, is that there was this Thor character, and I couldn't remember what he did that would make him the hero to Sarah. I didn't remember it was that he was a cheapskate and wanted to throw him out for only having $45 and not $50.
Yeah, he needs that $5. But yeah, Sarah's going to melt his heart by offering her helmet. Because that's why he's so grumpy. He doesn't have his Thor helmet on. He has that baseball cap on instead.
And that helmet's worth at least $5, but he lets her keep it anyway and gives them their car.
He has one at home.
That's what he says. And so, all right, I'm just going to throw this out there. Is he Thor? I mean, is this movie telling us he's Thor?
He is in my canon.
Maybe from, like, the Hulk TV movie, Thor.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, in this movie's universe...
I mean, he's better than Howard the Duck at this time. Like, better version of a superhero than that.
Thor's not real. So I'm going to vote he's not Thor.
No, but I'm saying in this movie's reality, is this Thor?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This movie doesn't exist in a place where there are superheroes. So, no.
No, I don't actually think he's Thor.
No.
The fact that he says, I have one at home, has always made me wonder if this movie was saying he is Thor.
You haven't dealt with kids. See, when you're dealing with kids, you want them to leave you alone. You just lie to them. Tell them whatever they want right. to hear, yeah. so they leave you alone.
Yeah, he's suddenly charmed, all out of character. He's suddenly like, oh, I love this little girl, and I'll tell her I'm Santa Claus. You know, like, that's the way I take it. It's like, I'll play along.
As a kid watching this, this was always a fun scene. Like, I always enjoyed this. That, yeah, the big tough guy, actually, maybe he is a superhero, or he's acting like one at this point. I don't know, it was always a nice moment when I watched this as a kid.
And again, coming back to rewatch this, I'm like, they've got their car. They pick up Brenda and go home. Wait a second. I know that somebody has to dangle off a building. Why do they have their car back?
Well, you know, we've had all the fantasies come true. We've had Daryl make out. We've had Brad get a hug. We've had Sarah meet Thor. Now it's time to disillusion Chris. It's not enough that she met a nice guy, but she's got to realize that Mike is a not nice guy. She's got to see that French restaurant she was supposed to be at and then see that vanity license plate parked outside, as well as the ad for a Playboy. Was that a thing? Could you go around and see billboards for Playboy?
I mean, they still had cigarette machines, like vending machines. You just pop a couple quarters in and get a pack as a kid back then. So why not?
I guess you're right.
I didn't live in a big city, but I would like to think I'd remember Playboy ads, and I never remember one.
I could imagine in its heyday when publishing was king that you would have had this kind of thing over a parking lot.
There are articles in it that are very classy.
Yes, we all love the articles. And Chris is going to storm in there and confront him. I don't know. I thought this would be better. I thought it would be more satisfying for her to realize and tell him off. But it's really a moment for Daryl. Daryl got his ass kicked last summer, and now he's going to kick this guy's ass.
Yeah, honestly, Mike gets the best line here, despite how hurt and mad Chris acts. When Mike says that she's locked at the knee, I mean, even Luann there gets a laugh at that point. I mean, Mike wins the verbal confrontation. It's only when Daryl decides to literally kick Mike in the ass.
Yeah, I know who doesn't win is Brad. Like, he is falling so hard for Chris. It's just kind of funny. Like, I'm not gonna sink down to your level. Like, get off your high horse and punch the dude. Thankfully, Daryl finally does something I like. And like you said, Arnie, kicks him in the butt.
Yeah, I mean, this moment for Brad is as cringe as when Elizabeth Shue is singing earlier. The speech they give him to say about, you're slime and I'm not going to go down to your level. It's like, this is why I'm Team Daryl, not Team Brad.
Well, because we don't believe that. Because in the real world, we don't believe these moral high horses. We know that people fight dirty and act base. And Daryl reflects the world of this movie. So, yes, it's what we want to see. Meanwhile, Sarah's grabbing a French pastry and slipping out to gawk at a toy store window display, and this gets us to the climax you talked about. The mobsters have been following. I don't know why they knew the garage that the car would be serviced at.
Joe Grip told them. They finally went back to Joe and is like...
But why would he know?
I don't know. There's a whole scene where they're like, you're going to tell us everything. And so you're just to assume that he told them.
I really don't think that he knew. I think that this is some kind of retcon.
I'm fine with it, because even as a kid, like, this is where I was ready to be done with the movie. Like, I don't like all this Sarah hanging off the roof stuff. It feels really elongated. It could have been tightened up. Like, as an adult and as a kid, I'm ready to end the film at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
Because this is the poster. This is what they promised you the whole movie would be. I would have figured you were waiting for this stuff.
I mean, maybe the first time I watched it, but I on number 2 through 2000, I knew that was that movie cover wasn't going to happen.
It's not very funny. I'll give you that. It's not particularly hilarious that the kid goes out on the window and dangles on a rope.
I literally get vertigo watching this scene these days. I mean, when I watched this at home as a kid on like a 24-inch TV, it did nothing to me. But you put this on a theater screen, and I know that this is blue screen fakery, but man, if the thought of this doesn't get to me, the fact that they're in the Windy City, it's just going to take one gust to blow that girl off. And again, so we have Chris at the dinner party hiding under a table. The Andersons are right on the other side. Chris sees Sarah dangling out a window.
No one else does.
Yes, nobody else sees her. And Chris doesn't immediately yell, "Get a fire truck. We need emergency services. This girl is going to die."
The child fantasy, though, is like, you take care of it yourself. You are just as capable as an adult to solve these problems.
That would have never occurred to me in this movie that that could have ever been an option for these characters. Her whole reputation is riding on the fact, her ego is that she can do this. That she can do this simple run down to the downtown Chicago and pick up Brenda. And she's not giving up on that yet. This is all Ferris Bueller, I'm going to get home before the principal busts me kind of shit.
Well, that's after they save Sarah, but this Sarah rescue is the one moment with the parents right there that it's like, you need to be a responsible babysitter and call the fire department.
Yeah, I don't agree with you there. Where I do agree with you, though, is the effectiveness of these outside shots, especially when Graydon is, like, trying to climb down there with no rope. Like, I know, like you said, it's blue screen, but they do capture some danger in there. Like, even as an adult watching this, I'm like, ooh, this feels kind of dangerous.
The fact that it's a sloped building, and I did look up this building because I'd seen it so many times, I knew nothing really about the building.
I mean, this is your home state. I thought you would know all about this.
Well, what I didn't realize is that the building is actually referred to as the Vagina Building because it has a slit up the front of the diamond.
Oh my gosh.
I read that in Wikipedia, but I never called it that. It would have been new to the skyline at this point. I think the reason why they feature it is not for any kind of subversive sexual innuendo, but because it was the latest thing that you would have seen. It opened in 84, and this movie's coming out in 87. So if Ferris Bueller went to the top of the Sears Tower, this does it one better.
It is a new building, but it's also very cool because of that slanted roof for this exact scene. If you'd just gone vertical, we've seen that so many times in movies, but to be able to slide slowly down windows like this...
Yeah, give some credibility to the action. Like, you wouldn't just fall off this building because it is slanted.
Sure. If you want credit, I'll give it credit. But I feel like you want a big ending for this kind of thing. And they promised us this. It's just not particularly convincing. And, you know, it's not particularly funny or exciting. But it is the ending we expected. You got mobsters here. It's Home Alone, right? Like, you gotta have the part where the mobsters get knocked on their ass.
But is it basically murder to leave Graydon out there? I mean, they could throw Graydon a rope. By not giving him a rope, they're pretty much saying he's going to die.
But no one's experiencing this movie that way, are they? I mean, this is called comedy. Like, no one's thinking about death.
And Joe does say he'll throw a rope out there eventually.
Yeah, we see that he's the cool one because he'll be the one. He does take the porno mag back. So I guess Daryl will have a comeuppance there. There's no way that he won't get in trouble for stealing his dad's mag.
Like, his dad wouldn't notice the chop shop notes on the centerfold anyway.
I know, that's what I always thought, but this is a real Cameron moment. Like, we don't see Cameron confront his dad after the whole card Ferris Bueller, and Daryl's in the same boat. We'll never see that confrontation.
I suppose so. Daryl doesn't seem that fazed by it either. I guess when you're about to be murdered by Chicago mobsters, you can face your parents afterwards.
But yeah, this is where we get the speed home montage and beat the parents. They drive 45, so we're going to drive 80 and hurry and clean up and do all that. Again, as a kid, this is fun stuff, just trying to beat the parents. As a child, you want the kids to always win over the parents.
You know who gets screwed in this ending is Brenda. Brenda's had a rough night. She ran away from home. She finally gets her ride. And when they get back to the house, it's like, Brenda, leave. But I need emotional... Brenda, leave.
She's got to go home to her abusive stepmom.
I was about to say, I don't know what's going on in Brenda's house, but it's probably a much darker... That movie's rated R. I can tell you that. At any rate, I don't catch that Sarah lost a roller skate. That didn't ever click with me in this movie. Was there a moment where she was wearing them?
She says it in the car on the ride home.
Yeah, she's wearing roller skates in her home at the beginning and is told to take them off, but we never see her leave it behind in Dan's car.
We don't even see her use them in downtown Chicago. You set this thing up and we have a climax where she's on ropes and stuff. It had to be a thought at some point that she would put on the roller skates to skate around or something.
Yeah, she's not like Tootie from the old Facts of Life where she never took them off. I mean, that would have been a better character defining trait.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess the point is because she left it behind, it's a reason for Dan to come and court Chris.
Yeah, it's a good thing he got there when he did. Was he going to knock on the door and go, hey, I got this skate, and now you got to explain, like, why is there a dude at 1 a.m. knocking on the door with this kid's skate? It's again, it's a silly adventure fantasy movie, so I go with it. But yeah, trying to think about the real-life repercussions is pretty entertaining.
And I feel like the parents already would be a little ticked. I mean, if the babysitter, like, the kids are still up and watching, like, a violent gangster movie in their room. Like, I feel like you were required to put them to bed.
I think that the point there is they've dealt with real gangsters, so now this gangster movie doesn't affect them.
Uh-huh. Except the parents don't know that. And again, my parents would be very mad at the babysitter if I had broken curfew.
But because she broke up with Mike, we're able to end with Chris giving a kiss to Dan.
A reprise of the song.
Mm-hmm. And if you stay through the credits, Graydon is still out there on that ledge.
Ferris Bueller moment, an end credit scene in the 80s. I mean, those were exceedingly rare. But Jacob Stewart, ain't nobody getting out of here without giving this movie a recommend. Jacob.
It's really tough for me to come to this one objectively. Like, I can't. There's certain films, and yeah, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, like, everyone watched those a million times as a kid. But then I feel like every individual has those, like, weird films they probably watched all the time. Like, for me, this one, Karate Kid, I watched a lot. That's still a really good movie, though. And then, like, Teen Wolf, like, that Michael J. Fox film. I don't know if that's a good movie or not, because I've seen it so much.
It's not a good movie.
It's comfort food at this point, because I watched it so much as a kid. But, yeah, watching this as an adult, there are some pacing issues where it feels like it's stalling. Like, you could have made this a little bit tighter. But overall, like, look, even though I guess children's entertainment is much edgier these days, like, I always appreciate stuff that's not quite appropriate for the audience it's made for. Treat kids like adults, make them grow up a little. And this fits that one, especially at the time. Like, even though most of the versions I watched were the self-censored, dubbed ones my parents made because they didn't like the F-words in it, it still felt like a dangerous film because of the Playboys, just kids running around the city. Yes, maybe I am that white suburban stereotype where, yeah, it feels like an adventure to go downtown and it's dangerous and that's what adults do. And so I think there's still some fun. Like, it is not the great film I thought it was at like 12 years old when I watched this repeatedly, but it was fun coming back 30 some years later. And it was interesting seeing my wife like get into it because of that blues soundtrack. My girls got into it eventually. Like, they're kind of like, it's so bad it's good for them. Like, they couldn't deal with the wardrobe. Like, that was blowing their mind, all the rainbow colors. But yeah, like, this is a fun throwback film. It's like not the greatest thing ever, but if you are stuck babysitting a child, yeah, put this one on. You won't be bored. Recommend.
Stewart.
Yeah, I agree. I recommend the film, and I don't even have the nostalgia that you guys have for it. I have nostalgia for the 80s, and I'll tell you what, put side by side with Ferris Bueller, like, Ferris is annoying. Ferris's self-righteousness, all that, I gag on that stuff now. I'd much rather watch this, yeah, dirty little kids film. It's more in the style of the kind of movie I like. I just want to point out, many people say, oh, you don't like kids films. True, that may be, but I do love the After Hours, Warriors, let's go into an urban environment at night and watch things go wrong.
R-rated films, not kids' films.
I know, yeah. After Hours is one of my favorite films, and this does feel like the high school play production of it. Like, it's not good. I can't say that, like, this is a good film, but it is a very 80s indulgence that I think, yeah, if you want to relive what the 80s was for children, this has the spirit of it. And I do think, yeah, you'll have a good time watching the movie.
And coming back to it, and especially watching it two times in 2 years, this is a very flawed film.
Terribly, yes. I mean, it's not good. By any regular measure, this is a bad film.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to put it out there. The pacing on this is really off. As mentioned, the singing scene needed to come later. The car perhaps needed to be a little bit later, because when Thor comes down from the heavens, your problems should be over, and yet we're still going to hang off of a building and things. So I feel like this movie needed some rearranging, a little bit of redoing, and honestly, 10 minutes shaved off of it. I'm kind of with Jacob. Maybe not quite at the moment where you are, Jacob, but this movie needed to be 90 minutes tops, and it goes a little over 100, and I feel it. I feel it every time, and there are certainly some cringe moments and things that just don't hold up today, like calling Thor a homo and his negative racial stereotyping.
Teen prostitutes in a children's film.
Almost everything that it says about people that live in the city, in urban environments, it gets completely wrong.
We're just one needle in the gutter away from every stereotype. But that said, this movie is fun. It definitely keeps it going. I don't find any of the characters annoying in a bad way. You know, I do think that Daryl may be a little bit annoying.
You didn't have a Goonies moment with these kids.
No, I didn't. At no point are they screaming too much. When they're running, there's reasons for them to be running. They're not screaming the entire time. They're... Various skits get hit or miss, and some of the logistic connective tissue is tenuous at best as from how they get from skit to skit, but more of the skits hit than miss. And so, yeah, definitely a right there middle of the road recommend. Despite how many times I've seen this film, I can't, you know, jump up and down and say this is one of my all-time faves. It's one I watched a lot, and it's a good movie to recommend and not spend a whole lot of time thinking about. Unfortunately, I had to keep thinking about this because there is a remake, you know.
I saw this. Did you watch it?
Two of them. I want to point out, 2 years later, they tried to put it on TV.
Oh, no.
And they didn't get past the pilot. But I watched it. Adventures in Babysitting, either of you dare with this one?
Had no idea.
I didn't know that the pilot was accessible. I knew that there was a pilot filmed. I didn't know it ever aired.
It's called YouTube, and it has so many delights. And what's funny about it is it really thinks that it can recreate this movie beat for beat. To me, it would be like, get the girl, and then she babysits other kids each week,
yeah.
Right? No, it's the same exact kids. The girl's still holding the Thor mallet. Brenda is now working at a convenience store that gets held up by criminals. And for some reason, they end up in a sinkhole with an alligator, like they sliding around. It's more star-studded. I will say that instead of having Keith Coogan and Anthony Rapp, we get Joey Lawrence before Blossom. Yeah.
Whoa.
And Brian Austin Green before 90210 and his fantastic rap career.
Nonstop carnival, baby.
I wonder if he and Megan Fox watched this late at night. It's yes. And it was all about them. That was the strange thing, was that the fake Elizabeth Shue was kind of a minor character, and it really ended up being about Joey and Brian Austin Green.
What year was this? Because this sounds like the Weird Science TV show where, yeah, it was never about what Lisa or whatever her name was. It was always about the two boys.
Yeah, it was 89. So they made the pilot. They aired the pilot. You can find it on YouTube.
It sounds to me more like a Mr. Belvedere situation, where it would be the babysitting, but we're focusing on the family and the nanny type show.
Again, the fact that she was babysitting them, you almost forget. It was more about how do we create all these pratfalls and have the alligator pop out, and it looked particularly bad on the TV budget, so... Got to say, an epic fail on that. But yes, they did actually remake it for Disney Channel in 2016.
Yes, not Disney Plus, Disney Channel Original, their 100th original movie. So I did watch this on Disney Plus, and...
I mean, when 99 of them are High School Musical films, like, does that really mean anything?
It does mean something, because I have seen High School Musical films, and they are much better than this movie. I did watch this movie. Did you guys sit through this movie?
I watched this movie, and what's funny is I almost skipped it because I read the one-liner description of it, and it talks about rival babysitters and all of this. And I'm like, so they took the name. They didn't take the movie. They took the name.
Yeah, that's the vibe I got when I read about the summary for this. I didn't watch it, but it didn't sound like a remake of this movie.
The shock to me is how closely it does remake this film.
Agreed.
Do they use a penthouse instead of a Playboy?
No. Stewart's thought about how the kids get in trouble is more accurate. You've got two babysitters. They're people who knew each other ahead of time. They're rivals for an art internship. A cell phone mix-up has them both spending a night babysitting. But one of the kids goes into the city, which is never named, but spoiler alert, it's Vancouver. He goes into the city for a concert, and both babysitters and five children have to go and get him back, and they end up on the run from animal poachers.
This sounds like a Disney film.
It really is so bad. I just, like, just visually, like, it like looks like it was shot by a cell phone. Like, it just, it looks ugly, it's flat, it's unfunny.
No, but that's made for Disney Channel. I think all of that just comes with the package made for Disney Channel is this shot on a consumer-grade videotape look.
No, don't make me do the retrospective, because I'll take you to High School Musical and show you that's not true. I've seen Camp Rock. I've seen more than five Disney Channel movies, and this is by far the worst looking one.
But there are a lot of similarities. They do have to go into the city. Their car does get towed. They have no money to get it back. They end up at the parents' big gala, and they're hiding in the coat room. The young girl wears roller skates the whole time. They have to race to clean the house.
They can't have Thor because they haven't bought Marvel yet.
Oh, they bought Marvel by the time this came out in 2016.
Oh, okay.
Now, this did start in development hell in 2010. It was supposed to be Raven Simone or Miley Cyrus starring.
Or them against each other, which would have been fun.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is I don't know who these are.
Yeah, they're lesser Disney Channel actresses who had been in Disney Channel shows, but neither one of them is a star, nor do they have star power.
Mm-mm.
It's not a good movie, but hey, they did modernize one thing. There is a scene where they walk out on stage in an African-American club and nobody gets off stage until you rap.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. That's worse than the blues is white people rapping.
My wife and I have been going around for days just ironically going, we ain't no quitters. We're the babysitters.
Oh, no.
I do want to emphasize, unless Arnie is making this sound like Brown Arrow territory, no. The 1987 movie is Brown Arrow. This is just bad. It's really painfully, mostly unfunny bad.
I thought this was direct middle of the road. Anything I've seen on the Disney Channel, any of those Hannah Montana or other shows.
Who would have thought Stewart would have the strongest thoughts about Disney Channel movies?
No, because I've seen too many of them for you to like.
Why have you, Stewart?
Sell out Hannah Montana this way. She's much more charming than this.
I'm the one with kids and I haven't seen any
Listen,
of these.
I've seen iCarly and this is on iCarly level.
Mm-mm. You're wrong.
I would give this a recommend for people who like watching the Disney Channel.
Okay. Well, hopefully we never have to do another retrospective with Disney Channel product to have this debate again. But I will say, for me, it will hurt everyone. People new to the project will not like it, and people that love the original movie will be mortified at what they've done.
And I just enjoyed watching the car wreck of seeing what they turned this original film into. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't look away. But that's what we think. David, what about you? What are your thoughts now?
I think this turned out pretty well. I got three recommends. That's cool with me. Solidified my thought that it's not just nostalgia on my part, that other people, whether through nostalgia or not, also think this is a pretty fun movie.
Yeah, I was looking to Stewart's opinion because I knew Artie and I were tainted.
Right, yeah. If you were sold on something as a child, I call it brainwashing, really. Like, you can't be deprogrammed in one podcast, but I having a single viewing that I barely remembered. Again, I lived through the 80s and I have a love for its trashiness. You got to have nostalgia for that, but you don't have to have been turned as a child.
But David, thank you so much for picking this movie. I was telling the guys off air beforehand, I never thought we'd get to discuss Adventures in Babysitting on this podcast. So it is great that we finally did. And I'm able to talk about another childhood fave. Not quite as good as Real Genius, but one I've seen probably almost as often.
Best Thor movie? Maybe.
Well, it's better than the first two Thor movies, definitely.
And August patrons, I hope you're as excited as I am.
Nope.
The movie of the year that I've been desperate to see. This is the biggest movie coming out this year that I know about that I want to see on the big screen. Jordan Peele's third film, Nope.
Yeah, get some UFOs, it looks like.
And other things. Like, clearly this feels like there's a lot going on, as is in all Jordan Peele movies, more than meets the eye. It won't just be UFOs, but yeah, you gotta love anything that recreates the E.T. finger touch with a fist bump. That will be in the first week in August.
So thank you to all of our patrons who have pledged month after month to hear these bonus shows. Hopefully you are excited as Stuart is for Nope and join us then. And Jacob, Stuart, David, thank you for joining me. And until next time, remember, don't fuck with the Now Playing Podcasters.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Can we do this again next Friday?
Aw, Sarah. I think I'm retired.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
Where are we gonna get 50 bucks?
Maybe we could sell Daryl. You think?
And a special thank you to David for his incredible support of our show and for picking Adventures in Babysitting for our hosts to review.
I work on a cash-only basis. You slip me the cash, and I'll slip you the wiener.
But I don't have any cash.
Then I don't have a wiener!
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
I am not losing anything. I am still in control here.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
God, I don't know why you're making such a big deal about him.
Now Playing is edited by Arnie.
Have you been fighting the forces of darkness?
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Do you know how the Playboy unabashed dictionary defines oral gratification?
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Hey, we could put it in writing, huh? Everybody would sign it. We could take it to a notary till they
shut up.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Hey, I like danger, alright?
You should try babysitting.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I care about those things deeply.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Get out of my house!
Let's talk about it. Arnie, give him the plot.
Come on, you got this movie memorized. Just do it. Just do it raw.
I expected you to do it as a blues song, frankly.
That might be his recommend at the end.
Yeah, I'm
no
totally
one gets out of this podcast
it.
Without singing the blues.
I am not singing. There's no way. No.
Oh, man, I thought about it.
I'm crushed. I can't believe it. I almost did it myself.
I know.
But I'm like, Arnie will do it. Is there a Chicago superhero?
Man, now they're all like New York.
Yeah, I feel like everyone's in New York. I don't know why
she
believes...
I'm sure there is some obscure one that I'm just not thinking of right now, but...
Yeah.
I know that, like, Thor went to Iowa for a while. I think Des Moines.
Yes.
And Venom went to California, but I don't think that back then, anyway, anyone hit Chicago. I mean, they did kind of spread out after a while, so they weren't all going after the same bank robber.
Yeah. For whatever reason... I feel like trucker entertainment was coming to an end by the late 80s, but we had had a lot of it in the 70s, Convoy and what have you. And yes, it was a very much a stereotype.
Smokey and the Bandit, please. That you're going to put Convoy above that?
I'm not going to list them all. Hell, we'll probably end up doing a Smokey retrospective. I'm saving those thoughts. My point is that it...
It wasn't the whole eyelid torn off. It's just like the little corner of it.
Okay, good. All right, that's fine then. All right, one's fine for that.
Oh, you've activated my eye phobia.
Your eye thing. I'm sorry.